Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
It's Tom Bilyeu here. And if you are addicted to the relentless pursuit of greatness, then I've got something special for you guys. The Motivation Daily Podcast by Motiversity. It's your daily fix of motivation, inspiration, and wisdom featuring the best speeches and speakers on the planet. We cover it all. Life, business, relationships, discipline, purpose, mental health, sports, studying, focus, you name it. With exclusive speeches from heavy hitters like Coach Payne, Billy Allsbrooks, Marcus Taylor, Dr. Jessica Houston, Walter Bond, and more. If you're ready to take control, level up, or just crush your day, then Motivation Daily Podcast is your secret weapon. Search for the Motivation Daily Podcast and follow wherever you listen to amazing podcasts.
And when you stimulate mTOR, it inhibits autophagy, which is your self-cleansing mechanisms. So it actually works against you in terms of aging.
Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Health Theory. I'm here with Dr. Frank Lipman. Dr. Frank Lipman, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
I'm really excited, man. I read your book. It was really prescriptive, and that is something that I respect a lot. I think taking, you know, with every day that passes, it seems like health gets more and more complicated. And the way that you were able to distill it down and actually tell people, go do this, I thought was really powerful. And the new book, of course, are The New Rules of Aging Well, which I'm very excited to talk to you about. But I actually want to start back in apartheid South Africa, the insights that you have around like what apartheid is and what it stood for and why it doesn't work when you begin to extrapolate into things like medicine, I thought was incredibly powerful. So what was it like growing up in apartheid, and what did you take away as you went into medicine?
Well, you know, I grew up in the, I was born 1954, so I grew up in the 50s and 60s in South Africa during apartheid. But I grew up with very liberal left-wing parents. So I sort of grew up knowing that the system was rotten. So you just start questioning everything, and the medical system was just another system to question.
I heard you give a talk, and you said that apartheid stands for separate. And then coming into the Western medical establishment, you said that same notion of the separateness of not treating the body like a holistic thing. And that same, and I assume that's what you mean when you say that the system was rotten. So one, how did you begin to realize that? Did you hone in right away on that separateness, the way that they were treating the symptoms rather than the causes? Or was it when you got involved in acupuncture, you began to learn a new way? How did that happen?
I think, you know, I went to medical school. You know, my brother went to medical school. And if you're a smart kid in South Africa in those days, you went to medical school. I didn't even question it. And in the beginning, I got brainwashed like every other doctor, thinking Western medicine was the answer. But then after my training, I went to work in the bush, and I got exposed to traditional healers called Sangomas. And I noticed that some of the patients we weren't helping, that the Sangomas were helping. So it opened my mind a little bit to question the system or to realize that there may be other ways. But I was still, you know, heavily brainwashed by Western medicine, and I thought that was the answer. And then
if you had to put your finger on what the brainwashing of the Western system is, how would you define it?
I define it probably as a cult. You know what they do? They in cults, they deprive you of sleep. They force all this knowledge into you, and you're not really asked or to question anything. You just got to listen to the elders and, you know, follow the rules. And that's sort of, in a way, I mean, I know that's a bit of an exaggeration, but that's sort of the way we trained in Western medicine. This is the way it is, and you don't question it. And really, the only tools we have in Western medicine are, pharmaceuticals or surgery. So you don't think out of the box. We're not really taught to question or think about, are there other ways? We're not really taught to really look for the underlying causes of a problem. And we're not really taught to keep people healthy. We're taught to treat disease or serious disease. So there are many shortcomings in Western medicine. Now, look, Western medicine is fantastic if you're acutely ill or you break a bone. I'm not knocking Western medicine, but to take that model and use and extrapolate that model for all our problems in the culture today is, we end up with a very limited way of treating people and a very narrow way. And if you're not prepared to see the shortcomings of the system, then your patients suffer.
So, all right, we're back in the bush. What were they doing that?
Right. I haven't got a clue. I mean, they were throwing bones. They were doing weird stuff, which I thought was quackery. But because I was intrigued by the culture, to me, this was more interesting from a cultural perspective than a medical perspective. But I did notice that some patients that we couldn't help, were sometimes getting better. So it sort of was there at the back of my mind. And then after that, but I still thought African medicine was bullshit and there was nothing to it. And then I went to work in a private practice in the suburbs, in white suburbia. And I actually happened to work with a very hip doctor who happened to be the doctor for a lot of the detainees. He was also very progressive and liberal. He was also a little bit open and he had part of his practice were the sort of the artsy community of Johannesburg. So we'd have these artsy people coming into me and they'd seen the homeopath and they had gotten better. They'd come in and they'd tell me, well, my migraine, I went to the homeopath and got better. I went to the acupuncturist. There was one acupuncturist in Johannesburg. I went to the acupuncturist and my back got better. So I was, realizing that when I was seeing these people, they were coming in with problems that I couldn't help in Western medicine. And they were telling me they were going to these quacks and they were getting better. And I went to Paul, who is my mentor, the doctor I was working with. I said, Paul, what the hell's going on? And he laughed at me and he said, people get better in spite of what we do. Your job is to actually listen to them and support them with whatever they're doing. But that started really opening my mind. And then I emigrated to America because my wife and I didn't want to live under apartheid. And I had to get a license in New York. I had to do 3 years in an internship, and I got a job in the South Bronx because they sponsored me for a green card. Whoa. The South Bronx in 1984 was a pretty burnt out area full of crack addicts and heroin addicts, and American doctors didn't want to work there, so they were able to sponsor me for a green card. I started my residency there, and after a few weeks, I realized that I didn't want to be a doctor in America because the medicine was very different. In South Africa, we didn't have the money to do all these tests on people. We had to take a really good history, talk to people, examine them, and come up with some type of treatment protocol. In America, you just very quick history, very brief exam. You do a lot of bloods. You do an EKG. You do a chest X-ray. And then you read up about it and present it to the professor the next day. And there was no relationship. The relationship with the patient was not emphasized at all. And there happened to be an acupuncture clinic attached to the hospital doing acupuncture for detox. And because I was so disillusioned with Western medicine, I went to check out the acupuncture clinic. And I walked into this clinic in this burnt out area, in this room with about 20 chairs, with these heroin addicts sitting quietly with needles in their ears. And I went, phew, this is interesting. These were the same patients in the wards that were pulling out their IVs and they were swearing at you. I don't know if you've ever been around addicts getting off heroin or crack. And they're pretty tough patients. And in the wards, we're treating them and they were really difficult to treat because, they were aggressive and they were, shouting and screaming and you had to sedate them. And here I walked into this room and there were these 20 odd addicts sitting quietly with needles in their ears. So for the next 3 years, because I had to do 3 years in the hospital, I started spending my time between the hospital where I've seen acutely ill and, you know, sick patients, and then going to the acupuncture clinic and checking it out. So I saw then that the future would be the combination of the two, because the one was particularly good at one thing and not particularly good at the other, and vice versa. So it was like a no-brainer. I didn't even have to think about it. It was like so obvious to me that the future is somehow combining the two. And that was sort of the beginning of my journey.
The interesting part of that story, though, is that you go and present this stuff to your peers, and they basically do reject it. And they say, this is crazy. And if you go down this path, it's basically going to be the death of your career. So that, to me, when I heard you describe sort of the different ways of thought, like you said, Western medicine, you're basically thinking of the body as a machine. Yes. And what ends up happening is, when you're thinking from a pharmacological perspective, when the check oil light comes on, you put a Band-Aid over it so you can't see it. Right. And whereas in the Eastern tradition, you think of it as a garden. And when a leaf is brown, you don't paint it green. You go figure out what's wrong with the soil or whatever. And I thought, oh my God, that's really a brilliant analogy. And understanding there are times where you're going to deal with the body like a machine. Like I imagine in the Bronx, you must have at some point dealt with
absolutely.
Acute traumas and things like that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I just thought that was interesting. And I heard you speak sort of reverently about surgery when somebody's in a position where that's exactly what they need. And it borders on sort of miraculous. And so now with that in mind, what prompts you to write the new rules of aging?
Like so many other things in my career, it just happened because I just written a book called How to Be Well, where I thought I put a lot of my information from the last 35 whatever years of practice into a user-friendly manual. And I'd been starting to explore a lot of the, you know, there's been more and more research on aging lately, and, you know, becoming aware of all this new interesting research on aging. So I said, well, let's do a book on aging. And that's how it happened.
So as you dive into it, what were some of those early things in the new research that's coming out that really caught your eye, that people should be aware of, that are, you know, if they either heed the advice or ignore the advice, you know, it's going to have significant impact on their life?
Well, a couple of things I've noticed. You know, we do in my practice, I measure a lot of biomarkers, which are sort of the downstream measurements of lifestyle changes for the most part. And for instance, as a holistic doctor in the early days, I was sort of semi-vegetarian, mainly pescatarian, coming from South Africa, eating lots of grains, lots of fruits, no red meat. I thought that was the way to go. And I became pre-diabetic, eating what I thought was a healthy diet.
Were you overweight at that point? Or
I mean, I've never been overweight, but I had a bit of a stomach. For me, yes, I was overweight, but I thought that was just part of what it was. Yeah, I had a double chin. Yeah, I was. I didn't realize I was overweight until I went on a paleo diet, and I just automatically lost weight and felt fantastic. And I said, fuck, excuse my language, this is interesting. This sort of goes against what my thinking is, eating a lot of fat and, you know, protein and grains, taking grains out. And so I saw what happened to me, and then I started doing it with my patients, and I saw the excellent results with my patients. And then I was going along happily, and I started, when I started getting to the anti-aging research, you know, I started reading about, you know, what some people are calling longevity genes. And the research was showing that animal protein, too much animal protein, can actually stimulate the mTOR longevity gene, which is not good for aging, because that's the one particular gene you don't want to stimulate as you get older.
And because I went, well, it causes cells to divide too much? What's the problem?
The problem is animal protein, the amino acid profile, has got high methionine in particular, lysine 2. And a lot of methionine in particular stimulates this longevity gene. And when you stimulate mTOR, it inhibits autophagy, which is your self-cleansing mechanisms. So it actually works against you in terms of aging. Until you're about 40 or 45, you're growing and you're reproducing and you want to be strong. And animal protein is actually a good thing. I'm not against animal protein if it's well-sourced. But once you start getting to 45, 50, it's more about preservation and maintenance. And the way to do that is you actually want to keep that particularly important mechanism of autophagy going strong, because a lot of things start, your functioning starts decreasing as you get older a little bit. So you want to preserve as much as you can so that functioning doesn't decrease as much as it normally would, whether it's mitochondrial function or this self-cleansing mechanism. Self-cleansing mechanism is an important one. So I started looking for what are all the ways to prevent that happening quicker. You know, first of all, I started eating less and fasting. You know, I started looking for ways of stimulating or triggering these longevity genes or the autophagy mechanisms. So I started fasting more. Now I only eat two meals a day, for instance. I don't eat as much, and I still eat animal protein. I'm not against animal protein. I just don't eat as much. So I don't think one has to stop, but I do think, you know, it depends how old you are. But when you get into your 60s, you definitely don't want to lose muscle mass, because muscle not only keeps you strong and vital as you get older, but it also has a metabolic function. You know, everyone talks about osteopenia losing bone mass, but sarcopenia, the loss of muscle, is really important as you get older. So it's actually a tricky balance, this protein issue, as you get older. But I think you've got to find that fine balance, because you don't want to lose muscle mass. And actually animal protein is a good way of maintaining that. So it's finding that fine balance. You know, I use a lot of collagen now, because collagen, animal protein coming from animal collagen, doesn't have high methionine. So in terms of animal protein, that's a pretty good protein to use for in aging. So,
all right, before we add anything new, I want to go back through some of the steps so anybody listening can really begin to implement this. So first we go from a pescatarian, high grain, lots of fruits diet, causing pre-diabetic problems that we weren't really aware of. We go paleo, which I guess we'll sort of define as whole foods, higher maybe in protein and fat, lower in the grains and carbohydrates. Yep. We start feeling better. I'm guessing your inflammation is going down. Yep. Your weight loss begins to happen sort of effortlessly. Yep. And now this thing around, as we get older, we have to be more thoughtful about mTOR. I wanna park there for a minute. So if there is something in animal protein, in the amino acid profile of animal protein, that triggers mTOR, and mTOR disrupts autophagy, for the first time, I sort of really get why that then becomes problematic. So I get why you say, hey, sometimes maybe animal protein, but sometimes maybe not, because of, depending on your age, sarcopenia, you can go to the point where you're triggering no mTOR, which means you're not building anything, which means that now you can get yourself into a muscle problem. And so you've really got to find that balance as you get older. So,
right. But I think what I do want to say, because I don't want to, you know, we tend to reduce, you know, we're very reductionist in the way we think. It's not just about mTOR. I just think that's a factor to think about rather than the be all and end all. I think it's just, that's why I decreased my animal protein rather than saying animal protein is bad. You know, I don't think it's healthy when you're older just to keep growing and getting stronger and building and building and building. It's really that idea of, it's more about preserving and maintaining as we get older rather than growing stronger and stronger.
And because preserving you and give maintaining, your body a dangerous signal that could turn cancerous, why would that be bad?
Exactly. So you don't want too many things that are abnormal to grow, because if you're still into growth, unfortunately, sometimes cancers can grow too. Abnormal things can grow. That's the idea. So you want to sort of, it's a fine balance. And, you know, everything's working together. How you sleep, how you deal with stress, how kind you are, if you have purpose in life, if you have gratitude. So there are all these many factors working together. It's not just about, you know, people who are so rigid about their diet, whether it's a paleo diet or a vegan diet, I think is probably more unhealthy. I think just be smart about it and be aware of it rather than be obsessed about it.
And why you're saying that a vegan diet is more unhealthy than a paleo diet?
Well, for most people, I would say that yes. most of the vegans that I have seen as patients tend to be nutritionally depleted. You know, I have a couple of patients who are vegans and are really healthy. I think that's more unusual than unhealthy people eating a paleo diet, put it that way. But, you know, once again, I don't think there's one right diet for everyone. I mean,
do you think people fall into buckets though? Like,
yes,
because I doubt it's infinite variability, right? So people begin to clump into types. Have you ever given thought to, like, is it 5 types, 50 types?
I mean, you're asking really interesting questions here, Tom. you know, I think there are variations. And I think it's affected by your age too. I do think, especially as we get older, we need to eat less. And as I said, you know, less protein. I think the general rule for me is eating as few sugars and starches as possible is sort of generic. Then once you get beyond that, for some people, grains are fine. For a lot of people, I find grains are a problem. So my generic diet for most people is sort of a paleo or a low carb diet. Once we go from there, it's like, some people do better with some more. You know, I saw someone today who is on a keto diet, and I've seen so many people do really well on a keto diet. You know, she was on a keto diet. She couldn't understand what was going on. And we did a genetic profile on her. There's a genetic test I did. And sure enough, it came up that she had a difficult time with fats, too many fats. So you know, now we're going to cut down her fats, and she'll probably do a little bit better. So I think, you know, my standard diet would be a low carb diet for everyone. And then after that, it's, you know, it's sort of the balancing, how much fat, how much protein, what do you want to do? If you want to lose weight, sometimes just a high protein diet will do it. So it all depends on what your needs are. But, you know, once we get older, I think eating less, eating very low carb, and sort of balancing that protein need with your muscle mass is probably the most important. But I always like people to think of food as something they enjoy. I hate putting people on diets. You know, I think people need to learn to enjoy and their food and find a way of eating that's sustainable for them. And, you know, we're living in an interesting time because a lot of this can be measured ourselves, you know, the self-monitoring. Mm. You know, the whole biohacking world is interesting. I hate the word biohacking, and I find some of the biohacking world a little bit too yang and masculine. But the idea of monitoring yourself and making changes accordingly is very empowering and very, you know, so I think it's all good. I think it's how you do it and how you are with that information, because we can't lose that aspect of our humanity. You know, you've probably heard me talk about Ubuntu, you know, that African term, what makes us human is the humanity we show each other. You know, as I get older, I'm less dogmatic. I'm more aware of the subtleties in life and how important being kind is, how important, you know, someone finding their passion, whether it's with their kids or their work, whatever it is, all these factors that we don't really talk about or think about as powerful as diet. I mean, I think diet and sleep and exercise are really important, but are they more important than, you know, your humanity and whether you're grateful, whether you have purpose in life? So, you know, as you get older, you start looking at the world in a sort of, I do anyway, starting to look at, you know, looking back and thinking about so many of the people that were healthy and were unhealthy. Even some of the people who are eating really well, exercising, would get sick. What was going on in their lives? You start looking at these patterns. And the pattern I'm seeing more and more of, or I'm becoming more and more aware of, is, you know, these intangibles being probably even more important than, you know, what we look for in someone's health in terms of what they're eating, how they're exercising, how they're sleeping. I think sleep is another huge issue. My next
In today's highly unpredictable and rapidly changing world, the smartest move you can make from a financial standpoint is to actually understand how money works and how markets move. Because if you want to have any chance of investing your money wisely and growing your financial portfolio, you have to make a profit. And the only way that you're going to do that is either by setting and forgetting or actually understanding what's going on at a macro level. So whether you're a seasoned investor or someone looking for extra guidance, today's sponsor, Yahoo Finance, has got you covered with all the tools, data, and news that you need in one place to grow your knowledge base around what is happening in the world of finance and to make sure that you have the right goals and you're executing well. Yahoo Finance makes it easy to consolidate your accounts so you can effectively and efficiently manage your entire portfolio. Personally, I love how straightforward their platform is to use. It is very simple to get the information that I need. And Impact Theory's own chief financial officer is exactly the same, spending time helping me frame exactly what is going on from a global perspective so that I'm making the smartest decisions that I can. I definitely recommend that you check out Yahoo Finance for comprehensive financial news and analysis. Visit the incredible brand that so many great investors use at yahoofinance.com. It's the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com. Once again, guys, head there now, yahoofinance.com. If getting your hands dirty and taking good care of your car or cars is a passion of yours, then eBay Motors is here for the ride. Because I'm sure you remember when you first saw the potential in that beauty. And then through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you can make sure your ride stays running smoothly with eBay Motors. Brake kits, LED headlights, exhaust kits, turbochargers, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. It's Tom Bilyeu here. And if you are addicted to the relentless pursuit of greatness, then I've got something special for you guys. The Motivation Daily Podcast by Motiversity. It's your daily fix of motivation, inspiration, and wisdom featuring the best speeches and speakers on the planet. We cover it all. Life, business, relationships, discipline, purpose, mental health, sports, studying, focus, you name it. With exclusive speeches from heavy hitters like Coach Payne, Billy Allsbrooks, Marcus Taylor, Dr. Jessica Houston, Walter Bond, and more. If you're ready to take control, level up, or just crush your day, then Motivation Daily Podcast is your secret weapon. Search for the Motivation Daily Podcast and follow wherever you listen to amazing podcasts.
Books on sleep.
That's interesting. Yeah, sleep is something that's very near and dear to my heart. As somebody who's professing a lot about working hard and, you know, very yang, as you say, but I always am, I take time to tell people I sleep as much as I need sleep. Like, I prioritize sleep.
Right.
It is a unique form of misery to be tired all the time and you're just not productive. I do not understand people that just constantly sacrifice sleep. But I want to push in on this yin and yang idea that you were basically just walking us through, maybe not in name, but I have a feeling that that's exactly what you mean. You've got the yang of like exercising and, yeah, you know, tracking data and making sure, yeah, that your mTOR is in the right place, you know, like really going in on it. And then there's, are you loving somebody? Are you connected to people? Exactly. Are you grateful? Have you learned meditation and relaxation? And what's interesting is, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you look at that as important, not in some ephemeral way, but like it's actually impacting you physiologically.
Absolutely. No question about it. Yeah. And I think what's interesting and what's, you know, what's happening now with measurements, you know, with whether it's the Oura Ring and these new measurements where we can measure blood sugar, and we're going to be starting to measure more, you know, the self-monitoring. I think we're going to actually start becoming able to see how these yin aspects or these softer aspects are actually affecting all these other, you know, our sleep and how we feel You know, in the past, it was hard to put it all together or to ascertain, was it, are you doing well because you really love what you're doing and you got, you know, you're part of a community and you have love in your life, or is it because you changed your diet or you're sleeping better? And I think now with self-monitoring, and I'm very intrigued, I think this new age of medicine is going to be this whole combination of the blood biomarkers, self-monitoring, your genetics, maybe doing, you know, measuring your microbiome. And I think the next wave is, how do we put this together in a really sensible way to help people take care of themselves and let the doctors take care of acutely ill patients? Because ultimately, you should be your own doctor and monitoring what's going on in your life and making changes accordingly. And I think it's sort of heading in that direction.
Yeah, the one thing that I'm very curious about in your work is, as we move forward and we're balancing this yin and yang and we're looking at both sides, what are the things that we should be looking at? Are there certain biomarkers? Is there amount of time in the sun? Is there, you know, number of times per week that you're meditating, or is it strictly blood markers? Like, what are the things that we should be paying attention to that tell us we're on the right path?
Right. So the way I see this, downstream, you have your markers that you can measure. And then upstream is these lifestyle changes, or whatever you want to call them, that are affecting those. You know, now we have continuous blood glucose monitors. I think they're going to get more and more sophisticated in terms of what you can measure. I think the next wave is you're going to be able to do a prick and you can measure probably 15 or 20 biomarkers. You know, we do lots and lots in my office, which may or may not be necessary. But I think the biomarkers are something that is just one aspect to measure. Then you can measure your sleep. You know, you can have your Fitbit. There are many things you can measure. And then you can make your changes, your lifestyle changes, whether it's changing your diet, how you exercise, when you exercise, how you sleep. If you're angry and fighting with your spouse, if you're not happy at work. And I think a lot of this can be done out of the doctor's office. And I think a lot of it will be done out of the doctor's office, which is exciting.
Yeah, one of the things in there that I think is really interesting is that idea of beginning to track pattern recognition as it associates with blood markers. My wife struggled profoundly with microbiome issues for years. And the only real breakthrough came when she finally got religious about tracking what she ate and how she felt. And once she started doing that, you just find patterns that you never would have guessed.
Exactly.
And there were things that, you know, her doctor told her would bother her based on an allergy test, and they didn't. And then there were things that she was supposedly fine with, but just every time she ate it, she would have an episode. And so finally she was just like, I'm just going to trust, like, I eat this, there's a problem. Whether I can identify why there's a problem or not is totally separate. And so we ended up finding out, even though she isn't gluten, she doesn't have celiac and doesn't even register as gluten intolerant, if she eats gluten, it wrecks her stomach. And then
So here's an interesting thing. So now we have much more sophisticated or sensitive tests for gluten. So in the old days, you used to do a celiac test, which just tests 2 or 3 or 4 antigen. There's actually a test you can do now. It's called the Wheat Zoomer by Vibrant Wellness that actually measures 13 different gluten antigens. And a lot of patients, now that we're doing it, a lot of patients come back with the celiac ones negative, but they're still sensitive to maybe the gliadin or something else in it. So Your wife's experience is actually not atypical. And the other thing I find about the microbiome is, you know, you can be sensitive to a food and think it's a food, but it's actually your microbiome. And you alter the microbiome, whether you use antimicrobial herbs or whatever you do, your sensitivity to the food disappears. So this whole microbiome story and the gut story is fascinating. And I'm obsessed with it in my practice. I mean, that's what we deal with all the time. But I'm seeing now that some of the testing and people's experiences are correlating more. So we're entering a really interesting time in medicine. I mean, even in the last couple of years, I think things have got much, much more sophisticated, which is exciting.
That's exciting. There's no one size that fits all. I'm totally with you on that. But just like with diet, you were sort of, here's the thing I start with. It won't work for everybody, but this is sort of as close to universal as we're going to get. I'm going to lay out what I think is as close to universal for solving microbiome problems as possible.
Okay.
And you tell me if I'm totally crazy,
you've
experienced
it.
A lot more. So if I had somebody and they said, look, I'm having gut issues, I would say, okay, first of all, you're all sugars dead and gone. Stop with those. Refined carbohydrates, those are gone. You're going to kill your sort of, you're going to kill your nightshades. You're going to only whole foods, nothing that is, nothing that's gone anywhere near glyphosate, first of all. And then no grain fed at any phase. So grass fed, grass finished, the whole nine. That actually really matters if you're eating animal protein. No vegetable oil and no soy products. And did I say gluten? If I didn't say gluten already, no gluten.
Right. No,
I that's agree. About as universal as I can think of. And no dairy.
Right. I think that is almost right. My experience has been, because, just clinically, I'm just seeing this all the time. I mean, my practice is now full of a lot of young women in particular with autoimmune problems. And what I've noticed is a lot of the time there's a microbiome imbalance. There's either an overgrowth, or whether we call it SIBO or Candida, or there's this imbalance in the gut that the diet alone will not address. You need to use, I start with herbs. You need to use antimicrobial herbs to sort of kill the bad gut. That's very simplistic, but let's leave it at that.
Is there like over-the-counter stuff that we can get, or is this prescription?
Yeah, no, a lot of this is over the counter. This is where you start with. What we do is I usually use a lot of the companies are coming out with paired groups of these. I use different companies, but you sort of pair a mixture of antifungals, antiparasitics, and antibacterials together. And you see how they respond, because if you're on the right track within 2 weeks, or 3 weeks, people will feel a lot better. Their gas will get better. Their bloating gets better. They start pooping better. So you can actually tell clinically in a very short time. It's not that you solve the problem within a few weeks, but within 2 or 3 weeks, you get an idea if you're on the right track. And then once you see they're on a path, then you can maybe start adding probiotics, maybe. Then you can maybe start adding prebiotics, maybe, or resistance starts. The diet will always start off as you sort of talked about, but you need to do more than the diet, because so many people come in with, let's call it a severe imbalance in the microbiome that needs these antimicrobial herbs to actually treat them. I'd say 70% of the young women I see with autoimmune problems have a history of taking a lot of antibiotics as kids. So my generation of doctors, we used antibiotics so liberally when these young, let's say 25-year-old young woman was a kid, she had so many antibiotics, and that started altering her microbiome. Some people even probably start before if they weren't breastfed or cesarean section, but for the most part, it really starts with chronic use of antibiotics for chronic tonsillitis, chronic ear infections, chronic sinusitis, acne, urinary tract infections, on and on and on. So that's a tragedy, that's a real tragedy. And, I think it's changing. Doctors are less liberal with antibiotics, but it has had, severe negative consequences on a lot of people's health.
No question. Now, there are a few things that came up in the book that I was surprised to see make multiple appearances. One was mushrooms and one was CBD. Talk to me about, I'm more interested in the CBD because of, I have struggled profoundly with anxiety, and you mentioned that can be pretty useful with anxiety. So if you give us like the 30-second breakdown of mushrooms, and then I want to get to CBD.
Mushrooms are something that when you learn or you study Chinese medicine, mushrooms have always been a part of my training. Some of them have anti-immune effects. Some of them have, like lion's mane is good for the brain. So they have different effects. I mean, there's some interesting work. I'm definitely no expert on mushrooms. I'm just quite intrigued by them. And I use them a lot. I use them myself, and I recommend them. But I'm definitely no expert. And one of my proteges, one of the health coaches that worked under me, father had pancreatic cancer, and she went to help him, and he's actually much better. He's really done well. And she was using a lot of mushrooms and CBD and THC. So she also was someone who actually...
In combination, like specifically mushrooms, CBD, and THC together?
Yes.
Interesting. So I know a little bit about CBD, but not a lot. When it's oral, is it just a tablet?
Well, it can come in various, you know, there are various ways of getting it into you, from a cream you can put on, to vaping, to tinctures, to tablets. And the big things that I've seen it help with, and one of the few things that are as effective as CBD are for anxiety and sleep. It also can help inflammation. But the two big issues that I use it for a lot are anxiety and sleep. It just sort of takes the edge off. And certain strains, and everyone's different. The dosage people need and the strains people need seem to be different. But when you get something that works, it can be magic. From the beginning, I'm less concerned with research, although I think research needs to be done. If I see something working, I'll go for it and tell people to experiment. I mean, I've learned so much experimenting on myself and my patients. You see what works. The same thing doesn't work for the same, you know, for different people. So you need, you know, why is an interesting thing, but CBD is definitely one of those things. The dosage differs, different strains. I mean, I have CBD next to my bed. When I'm feeling agitated, I'll pop some CBD. If I wake up in the middle of the night, I'll put some under my tongue. So I love CBD.
So you take it in a liquid form?
Yeah, I take it because if you take it in a pill form, it's going to take a longer time to be absorbed. So it'll probably take a good hour to two before you start getting the effects. If you take it with a liquid form, you're going to get some sublingual absorption. Goes through the, you know, absorbed through the mucous membrane. So it works quicker. And obviously vaping, which I don't ever do, will work the quickest.
And vaping is problematic because of the particulate matter going into your lungs?
Yeah, exactly.
So I have, my wife has a loving relationship with THC, I will put it that way. And right. I've never understood it. I always thought it was crazy. I was like, this just makes me feel like I want to be asleep. And right. Then now with the explosion of different strands and stuff here, right. She had me try one that was supposedly like really creative. And I'm obsessed. Anything that can help me be more creative, I'm all for it. So right. I tried it and I was like, this doesn't even seem like the same drug that I had tried before. And it's right. simply a different strand. So I was like, right. wow, this is really interesting. Like there's yeah. so much to explore. So I have sort of renewed my interest in finding things that that can alter your consciousness is maybe the right way to think of it. I'm way too big of a chicken to do what they call the hero dose of mushrooms. That does not strike me as something I'm ready for.
Yeah.
But
well,
it's interesting.
To be honest, what I think also opened up my mind when I was much younger, you know, we did some LSD in South Africa when I was still at medical school and finishing medical school. And I think that may have, you know, it opens up your mind. You start realizing that, ooh, this is interesting. And now there's so much research using, you know, some psilocybin and for depression and for all sorts of things. So I think there's a whole area there that needs to be explored, and there's something there. It's not something that I do or know enough about or use for my patients. So, but I do think there's something there. To me, that's just another medication.
Right.
But, you know, with anxiety and sleep, I mean, sleep is such a common problem. Anxiety is such a common problem. And, you know, for so many years, it's been, you know, getting people to meditate, which is very difficult, and trying to you know, get them to deal with their stress using some nutrients like L-theanine and GABA, and then CBD comes, and like people start taking CBD, and like you're getting these really interesting results. So that's, you know, I'm always intrigued by new products or things like that. So that's why CBD got so much, got quite a bit more space than maybe something else in the book, because I do think it's an important and relatively benign therapeutic tool that needs to be explored further.
So knowing that lifestyle choices are your first go-to, if just in summary, you had to put together three or four things that everybody should be doing, whether it's cutting out sugar, more sleep, whatever, what are sort of your top three or four things that if everybody did, it would help them age better?
Yeah, cutting out sugar, more sleep, meditation, or something. You know, meditation doesn't have to be sitting on a cushion, you know, with a mantra. Your meditation could be knitting. Your meditation could be being in the garden, taking a walk. So, but sort of something where you're getting out of your, you know, that busy mind. I think that is, you know, really, really helpful. And I would put, you know, those things we talked about, being kind to yourself, being kind to others, having meaning. You know, I mean, you know, having a passion for something is so, is probably the most anti-aging. You know, when I think of all my patients who've aged well, they've all had some meaning in their lives. And the meaning may have been their grandchildren. It doesn't have to be saving the world. You know, but whatever it was really meaningful for them. You know, obviously exercise too is really important, but I do think those softer aspects and that having meaning to me is like probably number one, but not everyone can have meaning. But, you know, I think, you know, if you're angry all the time and you're not able to forgive and, you know, all these little things eat you up and have an effect on you. It's the ordinary things that we do on a daily basis that have an extraordinary effect on our health. So when you start making habits of these little things, like taking a walk in the forest, going for a walk on the beach, you know, spending time in nature, listening to music you enjoy, being surrounded by people you love. Now, these little things that we don't realize are medicine are just as powerful as any drug. So, you know, I think fasting as we get older, to be quite honest, or eating less and time-restricted eating, I think, is an incredible, I mean, we've seen incredible results with fasting in our practice with measuring biomarkers, especially whether we do an advanced lipid panel. I mean, we've seen remarkable results with people fasting. I mean, it's really interesting. Now, usually that's not fasting, and in the time that they're eating crap. It's usually going together with a much healthier diet. But I mean, there are these little things that you can do that are not expensive and make a huge difference. And you feel the clarity. I mean, I was always a huge believer in having a big shake for breakfast. And I used to put all my, you know, breakfast is the meal. You've got to have a big breakfast and you're going to feel great the whole day. And I never realized how much clearer I was until I skipped breakfast and I started fasting. And how much, like, you know, if you want to see me as a patient, come see me in the morning. I'm really on. So, you know, it's very interesting how we all get brainwashed to think a certain way, and something comes up and you change and you go, oh, that's interesting. And as you say, monitor yourself, see how you feel. The proof's in the pudding. You'll feel better. You'll either lose weight or you'll be more clear. You'll sleep better. I mean, things, you definitely experience changes in the way you feel. And to me, that's what's important.
Very well said. Man, this has been a lot of fun. Where can people connect with you online? Do you have a social presence?
Yeah, drfranklipman.com is a website, drfranklipman.com. And I have a newsletter, which is very good. I am on Twitter. I am sort of on Instagram. My health coach does my Instagram. I don't really do it. Mainly my website. I post a lot because I want to get information out. But I'm not the one who sits and answers and gets involved in social media per se. I like to just put the information out, and I'm too old for that. So don't expect me to answer you back on social media.
That is fine, given how much information that you're putting out there. And I will say that, you know, whether you tweet people back or not, given how much amazing information is in not only the most recent book, The New Rules for Aging Well, but your whole catalog is extraordinary and, you know, bestsellers among them. So highly encourage everybody to check that out. And speaking of things you guys should check out, if you haven't already, be sure to subscribe. And until next time, my friends, be legendary. Take care.